Sampy.
Charles.
How are you doing, man?
Doing pretty good,
So, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
You guys, we call it Rev 9.
Yes.
And so I wanted to come today. You had mentioned there's a thread on Channel 9 about asking you architecture questions, because you're essentially the architect of the back end, the way that, basically the way that Channel 9 is going to scale and perform and be reliable.
Yep.
And then, of course, we have developers who do front-end stuff, and they've done great work.
Yep.
So today we focus on the back end. You use a lot of technologies.
First of all,
I want to ask you a question. Let's get this out of the way real quick. Based on the on the V4 architecture, mm-hmm. what was the problem in your mind that you determined, and how much of it was based on code, and how much of it was based on where we were hosted and how that process worked? Let's just get that out of the way.
Sure. So I think that V4, I mean, I actually heard the story a lot. V4 began life as on10.net.
Uh-huh.
And on10 had a very specific, smaller set of features. In a lot of ways, it was a video blog that had a couple of different blogs, and you would comment on it. And that was kind of, that was what 10 was originally built to be. And so, actually, if you go back and you watch one of the really old 9 videos, which might be in the related section, depending how this gets tagged, you can see that we talked about, we had 3 big concepts that everything fit into. You had tags, users, and entries.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was kind of around those big 3. There are a couple of ancillary concepts, but those are the big 3.
Mm-hmm.
And current 9, or V4, works the same way. It's built on that same idea, but there are a lot more things in the buckets. Like an entry is every comment, every forum thread, every forum post, every video post, all the event stuff. There's even some things in there that are entries, like trackbacks and pingbacks are entries. Like, mm-hmm. there's all kinds of stuff that all fits into that same thing. And I think a lot of the reason we made that decision is there's a lot of what appears to be data similarity. When you look at the fields of an entry, or you look at the fields of a comment,
mm-hmm.
or the fields of a forum thread, there's a lot of the same thing. There's titles, bodies, authors, posted date, edited date, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of, you know, parent, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of similarity there. And that, I think, led us to think, well, then let's make these the same thing and then differentiate them based on type or whatever. But
okay.
So that kind of leads into the work that I started pretty much about exactly a year ago last summer.
Cool.
Where we had just finished up Mix videos, had just went out,
mm-hmm.
Which was based on kind of like the repolish of Oxite after the public trouncing we took in December, but that was cool. We spent January and February fixing it up, put it back out there, a new version. We built mixed videos on that, and the conference site to this day lives on as a child of that Oxite code base. So around that summer, PDC started spinning up. Eric and Nathan started working on that.
Mm-hmm.
And the new PDC experience, we had like the session builder and lots of great stuff for PDC 09. And I started working on Rev 9.
Perfect. So we are done with V4. We're not going to talk about it anymore today. It's over. It's finished. Rock and roll, brother.
Yep, yep.
So what did you do for V5? And take us through the basic architecture. And then, of course, this is going deep. So we're going to want to know exactly why you made the decisions you made, why you chose the technologies you chose, and how you think it's going to evolve over time.
Sure.
So without further ado, man, let's go.
Okay.
Introduce.
So, we actually did a pretty good segue there. So because old V4 was based on those big 3 buckets, and so that was kind of the first thing I went after, which was I sat down and just tried to think about, like, what is the model by which people interact with Channel 9? What are the core pieces of it? And I had a couple of the kind of mottos, like different things should be different, and, you know, eliminate complexity, that kind of stuff. And
okay.
but also at the same time, I ended up introducing a lot more concepts, but at the same time, it ended up, I think, resulting in a simpler system. So in Rev 9, there are basically kind of like 3 big, what I would always call space. I call them spaces. So you had like blog space, you had forum space, and you had kind of like learn space or training kit space. And so blog space is where things like where an entry lives, where a comment lives, all that kind of stuff. Actually, comment's a weird one. But like that's where entries live, and that's okay. You know, video posts. This is also where we have what we call, what I call under the hood areas. Areas are show, series, and blog. For a while, they were three separate things, but the more and more I stare at them, I realize they're not. This was one of the first kind of backpedals I made on my decision of making different things different. They're not actually different. The only difference between them is sometimes I split them into three different categories, or in the UI, I say episodes in this blank, and I'll put blog or show or series. And so that's the only difference. Okay. So they're all consolidated into areas. In forums, you have, obviously, the forum itself. You have a thread. You have a post. Forums. In Learn, you have a training kit. You have a unit. And you have a lesson. And so, in this model, a forum and a thread and a post don't become saddled with all of the same conceptual baggage and all that extra stuff that an entry really needs to worry about. Because it doesn't need that. Like, a forum post is never going to have 12 different videos, 3 different preview images, and a whole bunch of audio files, and comments on a blog want to be anonymous, but a forum thread post is different. And so this was kind of the first separation that I did. Now, there are some things that live here in the middle that are shared common amongst all of them. And that's users, and I think users is the only one that shares. Learn and blog actually share comments and ratings. That's actually done with a clever little implementation where I can hang comments and ratings on lots of different things. But so there's commonality, the biggest one being users. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that separate things are separate. The forums is an area of the site where you want to experience it like a true, like an actual web forum. I think for a long time we kind of ran away from concepts that places like PHBBB and vBulletin and a lot of kind of standard web forums used, and I kind of wanted to stop doing that and just say, you know what? Mm-hmm. People know how to use forums. Let's leverage existing knowledge. And so the forums feel a lot more like a standard web form that you would be on.
Great.
And by the same token, blogs feel more like reading a blog post with a video on it on a lot of other sites. The comments can be anonymous. We don't do a paging. We don't do the nesting and reply to it. It's a much more straight, flat model. Mm-hmm. There's lots of goodness that mm-hmm. comes when you kind of embrace that these things are different. And yeah, they share fields, but they're behaviorally different. And so I wanted to group the site based on behavior mm-hmm. and not just based on, hey, you happen to have 3 or 4 fields that have the same name. Because then you start to get into all, you start to hit some of the problems that we had in Rev9 or in V4, where you have to filter out, like, I just want entries, so I can make sure I filter out all the comments and the training courses and this and that and everything, and that code was kind of scattered all over the place. So that's kind of tricky. So this was the first kind of pass I made, is I wanted to kind of understand the model of what 9 was and the way people interact with it and the kinds of... It's not enough to kind of understand what a blog or an entry is. You need to understand all the different ways people see it, all the different ways it gets pivoted. Like, on the homepage, we show you 3 featured ones, and then we have the homepage kind of river at the bottom, and then there's the browse section, which views them this way and that way and this way and that way. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to... Once I understood kind of how the objects were arranged, I spent a lot of time figuring out, like, what's every way we're going to query an entry? And what are all those queries like? And what's kind of that... What's that set? And what are all the ways we're going to query a training kit versus a unit versus a lesson? And, you know, grab a forum and a thread and all that kind of stuff. And that led me down to... and so that was kind of the... Once I had this, I started to think about how are these things actually used? How do they interact? And also on the admin side, like, or I guess on the input side, what are the actions that are done to create form, create posts, delete posts, mark them as spam, doing, you know... edit them, same thing with entries and comments and how do users register and all that kind of stuff, and just figuring out kind of just mapping out the space of, like, what does the site have to do? And then once I understand kind of how many concepts there are, I can kind of pick the pattern that fits best. And so I know a lot of people, when they see, you know, database-driven website design, a lot of people go to a repository pattern, which generally is, you know, you'll have like a iRepository. Some people do like an OT, and then you'll have like a, you know, a get all, or like a get one, or maybe even like something that returns like an iQueryable, which I think is a fine pattern. But in my case, I don't need these this kind of generic repository that I use everywhere. The purpose of the repository is to be able to treat your database almost kind of like an in-memory collection. And that's a useful abstraction in a lot of places. In this case, though, if I'm going to get speed and I'm going to get perf and I'm going to be able to understand, like, when this page loads, how much stuff is it going to do, I can't afford to hide the database from myself. And I want to have interactions that go to the database and to either do stuff or to get data back, be explicit and to be clear. And I want to be able to, I want to have a code base that I can look around and figure things out quickly, that I can live in, that I can, when something goes wrong, I can understand. When I need to perf tune, I can understand. Mm-hmm. And so being able to move around quickly and know what something is doing is a very important design goal. And mm-hmm. so instead of using something like this with a repository pattern where I've got a couple uses of these, but then link queries kind of mm-hmm. scatter to the winds. Instead, what I use is these query objects is what I call them. There may be that pattern may be used somewhere else, a different word. But basically, for every query that runs in the site, I have one object. So the object that gets you the three featured entries is called featured entries query. And then there's homepage entries query and all forums query mm-hmm. and threads in a forum query and that kind of stuff. And there's a central query factory object which each controller gets that it can then ask for a query. Mm-hmm. And then by going through the factory, I can set the caching on it and the paging and all that kind of stuff. And like all the queries go through that. There's a standard interface and a standard base class for like a list query or like a single item query, one that gets you just an entry versus one that gets you a list of entries. But that's under the hood how I can now open up a folder and see every database query channel line runs because I can see every single class. And if I want to see everywhere that uses that, I can right-click and say show usage, mm-hmm. and it will show me every place I call that query. And so I can very quickly figure out what does a page do. I can go and grab all the queries that it runs. I can see who's running this query, what if I want to change it or get rid of it, who am I going to impact. Mm-hmm. That's a very easy, simple thing for me to find out. And so I've being a code base that's easy to live in, easy to change, easy to understand, I think is a very important goal, because one of the problems we have with V4 was that it was tricky sometimes to figure out exactly who was doing what and what kind of interactions was happening. Mm-hmm. But now that's a lot easier to figure out.
So essentially you made it more object-oriented.
In a way, yeah.
So can you, obviously we were talking about these query objects. They're types, they're classes.
Yep.
And so you could actually just string some together. You could inherit from one or whatever. So you have a base class that they all implement? Derive from?
Yeah, there's all. So here, I'll show you the object hierarchy.
Great.
So at the root, I have an iQuery, which is just anything that's a query. And all this guy has is some methods related to caching. Basically, a method you can call that, like, to set the query to be cached or not to be cached. Under that, it has two children, because there's basically two kinds of queries on the site. It has iList query and iSingle item query. I can't remember if this is generic, or I think these are the ones that are generic. I think I introduced the type parameter here. And so, I can't remember.
Fine.
So an iList query has basically two methods. It has count and list, which turns you, this list gives you back a, I think I call this method like page of results, which is basically, rather than giving you back the entire list and having a new page, it gives you a class that has the data for one page, but then you can ask it like there are 10 pages, this is page 4, the page size is 7. Basically, it's kind of a nice, richer object that is giving you back like an item removal. And count gives you how many total items will be returned by that query. And then single item just has single, which returns a T. And then all the various queries inherit from these. And so all the single queries actually just implement this interface directly because there's not much a base class can do for you. But there's a base class here that's called list query base, which didn't exist at first, and this is actually one of the things I do as I build the site. This class hierarchy kind of grew out of me needing it. Like, I would, after I built like 3 or 4 of these, I saw that there was some commonality in the list ones, and so I started to pull it into a base class. And so I didn't set out and draw on a whiteboard this big hierarchy and all this kind of stuff. It was more of a all right, well, I've noticed that I've written three classes that all need to do about the same thing. Let's pull that into list query base. And so list query base has a couple of helper methods on you. It has one called results, which is actually handy, which you give it a list of T. And what it'll do is it will make this page results for you. And then it also has, like, page size and page count, or page number, and that kind of stuff as helper methods where it'll set protected variables that you can get at in here to actually apply to your query. And there's actually there's another handy one that I really like that's called apply query parameters, which takes basically the underlying actual query object from nhibernate. We use nhibernate, by the way. And will take the caching settings that it got set and then row size and page number and all that stuff, and then call the right nhibernate methods to set it all for you. And so for a lot of these list queries, I'll have a method that, like, you know, builds up the actual query object with the parameters. And then I'll just do something like this. I'll say return results apply query parameters, and then my actual object, and that's it. And so for a lot of these, this is the final line. Well, before, it's, you know, it's actually three or four method calls that does some stuff, but I was doing this method call so often, I reduced, you know, let's reduce duplication and just make a couple of candy methods for that.
Cool.
And so a lot of them just look like, they look like this. And so that's how this helper class gets born. Now, there are some list queries that are weird,
okay.
that need to do things in a different way, or, you know, can't exactly rely on this, or I need to use some advanced nhibernate features that no one else does. And they actually implement ilistquery directly. Because the whole system isn't dependent on listquery base. This is for convenience under the hood. The query factory that you deal with only cares mostly about iQueries, but or ilistquery or things like that. And so you never actually, no one ever has to see listquery base. It is a helpful implementation detail. And in fact, as far as the rest of the site's concerned, it doesn't care how the queries actually work. All it knows is I can ask the query factory for a homepage entries query. I can tell it some, you know, some parameters, and then I can get back data out of it. I don't care where it goes. I don't care how it does it. Just do it. And so all of the database access is isolated inside these query objects, but they provide a very rich, strongly typed interface, almost kind of like a little, you know, domain-specific language in the API, so that the code you're writing is expressive and you understand what it is, but it's not, it's by no means tied to the actual database. You give it the exact information you need, it comes back out. And so if I wanted to start moving things from SQL Azure, where we have it now, to table storage or to flat files on disk, wherever I want to put it, as long as I can update the query objects to use that in whatever new API I want and return the same results, the site just keeps going. And I only have to change the section.
Cool.
Which is great. I mean, my goal wasn't to build something where I could swap out the data layer. That's a handy side effect. And I'm sure there'll be repercussions if I actually try to do it. But under the hood, this is how the queries will work. And then the actual implementations of these talk directly to nhibernate to construct criteria and query objects and actually run the query against the database, get the results, that kind of stuff.
So nhibernate.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about why you chose to use that. You're also fluent in nhibernate.
Yes.
Talk to us about what's going on here in your mind.
So nhibernate, for those who have never heard of it,
there are going to be people who
have never heard of it, is a object relational mapper that's open source.
Cool.
That's a .NET port/ improvement of a Java technology called Hibernate. It works very simply off of, in the base implementation, XML config files, that you write a little XML file that describes this type maps to a table named this. It has lots of conventions, so you can kind of be very terse in your descriptions, and it'll just figure it out. And then you describe your system to it. At runtime, you load up and create a session factory, which is the one-time thing that pulls in all your config and builds all the types and is ready to go. You then ask it for, you then can open a session, do some work, save the session. that's a very simplistic way of thinking about it, but it's okay. It's got a lot of features. Fluent in Hibernate is a library that's also open source that's built on top of it, Hibernate, that provides you a very clean way to replace your XML config files with nice code-based systems or even conventions where you kind of just tell your system, like, when I name a property, entry ID, map that to a column named ID, and that's the identifier, and you can kind of teach it about your system. I don't use that feature that much, but Fluent and Hibernate is really cool as well. So at Hibernate, we ended up picking, again, I picked this, I think like last August or September, so .NET 4 wasn't even out yet, and so all I really, my competing options were Link to SQL and Envy Framework 3.5, which are both great products, but from looking at what Hibernate enables me to do, which I can go into in a second, it allowed me to get what I needed and have to write the least amount of code. It's also a lot older, and it's based on a job technology, so it's kind of good with the upper hand. I think Envy Framework's doing some good stuff in 4 with Code First and things like that.
Sure.
But you know, we don't run on .NET 4, we're on .NET 3.5. Because
yeah. SP1.
SP1, that's right, the latest and greatest .NET 3.5. To diagnose some problem in Azure once, I did port it to V4, to .NET 4 very briefly. Mm-hmm. And it didn't take that long, so it's something I want to do in the future.
Okay, cool.
I want dynamic. But.
So we have a lot here going on here.
But let me show you some of the two big things that I like most of that
you
use in Hibernate.
Great.
The first is caching. So the only way I'm going to get the site fast is if I cache the, things a ton. And if I'm going to be in Azure, I need to scale. I need distributed caching. So right now in V4, and this is part of the problem that we're into, is every node is just using a local web cache. And so every time a node recycles, the cache is empty, and it has to run every query against a database every time. And that's sometimes how we'll get into like a bit of a death spiral, where a node will go down and have to start slamming the database, and then that will slow the database down, so another node goes down, then he starts slamming the database, and you just kind of get into this...
And the database is slammed.
Yeah, then you get into... And then no one can start up because because they can't get to... Yeah, so you get into the death spiral.
Yes.
So...
I like that name for it, by the way.
The death spiral.
Yeah.
So what Hibernate does is Hibernate has two levels of caching, and pretty much all ORMs have this first level, which is like session-level caching. I won't go too much into this because...
Yeah, people can find out about this one.
Has session level caching, which everybody has, which is inside a single session, if I ask for entry 1, 2, 3, 4, if you've already gotten from the database, just give it to me. But the thing is, the second level cache is more interesting. This exists at the session factory level, and what this thing does is it saves the results of queries and entities it's seen before for use across multiple sessions. So homepage loads, it has entry 1, 2, 3, 4 on it, you go to the permalink page, I don't need to hit the database again because it's already sitting there in the second level cache. Second level cache is pluggable. All you have to do is give it an iCache provider implementation and implement the 4 or 5 methods and you're good to go. So our second level cache is powered by memcached. And so I actually have my own, so I wrote the driver here. It's maybe 100 lines of code. It's super thin because the methods for front end Hibernate second level cache are like get, put, clear. Mm-hmm. And the methods on the memcache driver are like get, put, clear. And so it's basically just pass it through and pretty simple stuff. So the ability just to plug that in and have it just work and have Hibernate figure out all the caching logic for me saves me a ton of work. There's a lot of optimization I tried to do to the caching in Rev9, but it was all... it was all us. It was all our code, all figuring out all of it, and trying to build kind of our own system. Yeah. And with this, I don't have to write code. That was kind of one of the other goals of Rev9 was, if I can delete a bunch of code and lean on a respected good library, I'll do it.
Good.
Because the less code that... I want to be writing code that only I can write that applies to Rev9 and that is channel line specific. I don't want to have to write plumbing code or engines for this because I'm not in the engine business. I have to get a website running.
Great.
But Memcached, actually, and this is another thing that's on the list. Memcached is the simplest of little demons, hence the little D, that just runs and just listens on a port. There's a protocol you call get set, you get stuff out, it keeps it in memory, that's it. And so there's a driver I got out there called Enyim, which if you search Enyim Memcached, you will be sure to find, that is a .NET driver for this. And it's actually really well written because it's written in a very similar manner to the way that I like to code, which is lots of interfaces and things like that. Mm-hmm. One of the interfaces you can give his library is basically a node locator. And it's just whenever the driver needs to find a memcache node, it calls you and passes you the cache key. It basically says, where should I put this? And then you give it back an iMemcache node, and then it will call it and all that kind of stuff. And what that lets you do is like that's how you support like kind of like farm scenarios.
Perfect.
And this is someone actually asked in the thread, is there any part of the code that wants to
speaking of which, we will get to those questions.
We'll get to the thread, yeah.
And you know, unfortunately we took a lot of sidetracks, but
yeah.
There are some good questions.
There are some good questions. Someone asked, like, is there any part of the code that makes you want to jump up and down like a little girl and scream? And this is actually part of it. So Enium supports different algorithms to basically decide, given a cache key, how do I decide which node to send it to?
Okay.
Because you want to have a good distribution across your cache nodes, all that kind of stuff. So the algorithm is called Ketma. Again, if you search there, Ketma. If you search that, you'll find it's pretty easy. So Ketma basically works like this. It takes all of integers from 0 to int.max. Say you give it 5 servers. You have servers A, B, C, D, and E. For each of these servers, it generates about 100 integers, just hashing them or whatever. So then you get distributed across this list of all integers. You got A, D, and then like B, and E, C, and all that. So they're kind of distributed, and there's multiple instances of each one. A key comes in, you run it through a hash, and then you basically get the hash value, which is an int. You then take this int, and you find it on the line, and then you basically move up until you find a cache node. If you happen to land right on one, awesome. I've not used this one. The best part is, as nodes come and go, I can just take them out or put them back in. Hmm. And the cache will kind of rebalance itself. So say, for example, I'm in this state, I've got 5, cache key comes in, I send this key off to E. The system rebalances, and then now I've got an F. Ends up being an F here. The next time somebody comes in and asks for this key, I'll send it to F. F won't have it. It'll be a cache miss. We'll collect it. We'll send it to the cache. And so now it's sitting in F too. And so what this lets you do is dynamically change the number of nodes by, you know, not you don't actually modify the list. I just rebuild it every time. But as things continue to come in, you will, as until the fabric changes, you'll always go to the same node. But as soon as the number of nodes changes, this array changes, and you might go to a different node, or you might keep going to the same one, depending on where you end up. Yeah. But, so he has an implementation of this algorithm in his library, so I can lean on that. So all I have to write is essentially a piece of code that does something very simple. And I've been meaning to blog about it for a while, so I'll see if I can clean up and share it to people. But basically all this thing does is there's an event on the Azure Fabric called configuration change. So in my node locator, when I first get my node locator first gets created, I query the Azure runtime and I say I would like all the instances of the memcache role. I have two roles. I have the web role and I have the memcache role. It gives me all the instances. Ask for all their endpoints. So I've got all their IP addresses and all the ports they're listening on.
Mm-hmm.
I can then, you know, I make those A, B, C, D, E. I spread them out. I make a Ketma, whatever. I'm good to go. Then the site starts working. This code's running inside the web role, by the way. This isn't actually running on the memcache nodes. Config change fires because Duncan goes in and turns up the memcache nodes from 5 to 6. I catch config changed. I check that. I basically just kind of reinitialize myself. I ask the Azure framework. I would like, you know, all the endpoints for this. It gets them. I generate, you know, the Ketma, and I unlock,
mm-hmm.
and then I keep spinning. And so as basically what now we have is an elastic cache cluster.
Cool.
I can just go in and just turn up the number of memcache nodes in the Azure UI, which is very simple, and the web roles all just adapt. And all of them have this code running and listening for the event, and so when the config change goes out, all of them just change on the fly and keep rolling.
Excellent.
For example, the IP filter that we turned on because people figured out the URL of the site.
Yeah, it wasn't very hard to figure that
That's
out.
That's true. But it's an Azure setting.
Mm-hmm.
And so all we have to do is go in and change the Azure setting, and the code that decides whatever request comes in to filter it just asks the setting every time.
Mm-hmm.
And once the setting's changed, it starts getting a different answer, and the site just changes behavior. And so that's mostly what we use the Azure settings for, is those kind of like things we want to be changing while the site's running. And the biggest one is it'll listen for the number of node changes. And you can also turn up the number of web nodes, and it'll just you know, the load balancer will just start sending requests to them. And because they're all hitting this same centralized distributed cache cluster, a new node doesn't have to, you know, get a bunch of stuff from the database and fill up and, you know, get its cache ready before it's, you know, ready to roll. Because it just hits this cache and just goes. The cache is running, it's fine.
Cool.
And so caching is the number one. There's also a bunch of interception stuff, but we can... That's a little less interesting. One of the things it lets me do is I can put interfaces on types, like post and comment both have an interface that's called iFiltered for spam. And
great.
Anything I put iFiltered for spam on will just get filtered for spam kind of for free.
And that's using a library as well?
Yeah, so that we actually call out to the Akismet service.
Great.
To do that. And that is that's all done with an interceptor. And so basically I wrote a class that says every time you want to save an entry, you want to save something, you know, try and cast it to this interface. If it works, let's run it through a spam filter. And if the spam filter says it's spam, I actually don't even send it to the database. I just throw it in my, you know, my deleted pile of trash. So if Akismet says it's spam, it never shows up on the site.
Perfect.
And that's and that's completely orthogonal to everything else. Just a little. And I've got a couple other ones in there, like some filters to hide like entries that aren't published yet, and all kinds of stuff that is very easy. I can just kind of tell and hibernate what I mean and get what I want. And there's a lot of value in that.
Excellent. And I mean, in some sense, you've also not just programmed for yourself. I mean, there's other developers on the team that you wanted to provide some a nice surface for them to easily consume all of these services that you've been working
exactly.
on.
Exactly. And that was the other goal, was that I wanted to, and why we ended up using a Vue engine, the Spark Vue engine, to get the master of segues. I wanted to build a system where people who were good at HTML, CSS, and JavaScript could write as close to that, to like static HTML and JavaScript, as they could. And feel like they're working in something that is as near native as they can be. And there's not as much logic, there aren't big code blocks, there's not like controls and concepts. Like it's a world where they work the way that works best for them. And Spark nails a lot of that. A lot of that's also building kind of the objects I pass down to that layer, building lots of utility methods, helpers, and that kind of stuff. And there, you know, there are still some blocks of code. There are still some places where, you know, putting in like an HTML helper for those familiar with MVC makes sense as opposed to writing out the tags. But it's about finding that balance. And I could guess at a lot of it before, you know, when it was me and Duncan before we had hired Kara and Joff. But once we had them here, when I have an idea like that, I often go to both of them and say, does this fit with what you want? They usually say no, we refine on it. And then we just did this, for example, when it came to designing how we wanted to do script combining and minification. And I originally designed a model where you would specify like all the scripts and script tags, and I would dynamically replace the crunch them at runtime to a combined script. And they were like, well, it's just much easier just to have one line that just names the combined script than in dev explode them. And I was like, oh, well, I was trying to avoid that, but if that makes sense to you and you like it, let's do it. And so that's the kind of relationship I want to have, is I see my one of the roles of the back end, other than trying to be as fast as I possibly can, is to enable them to work in such a way that lets them get done what they need to get done, express what they need to express, and basically just get out of their way. I'm an okay front-end guy, but I'm not the greatest in the world, and that's why we hire other people who are really, really good at it and who specialize in it.
Excellent. Well, it makes perfect sense, man.
Yep.
So that's how teams should be. Now, what's going to happen is you're going to probably be on cloud cover. I mean, I probably shouldn't. Well, I am going to, because now we're going to have to force the issue. Ryan's right next door.
That's true.
You're going to be on cloud cover. Steve and Ryan are probably going to have you kind of drill into what you've done for Azure specifically. But for the purpose of this, I do want to talk a little bit about, you know, it's great that we are making the bet on our, basically, it's the future. Talk to me a little bit about what the changes were. I mean, it seems like it wouldn't be rocket science to go from ASP.NET running on a real physical machine to ASP.NET being hosted in Azure. But you had to do a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
So talk to me about the transition.
So when I first started doing the experiments were in Azure. Duncan and I would always joke about it, and then I was like, well, let's see how we do it. And so he was working on pushing tech ed out there and visit mix and things like that. And so I figured let's give Rev9 a shot. And at first it's very easy, because if you don't need to take advantage of anything, if you don't need to leverage something specific for Azure, you can just kind of move. I mean, you got to learn the tools and package and a couple things like that.
Sure.
But if you have no interest in using any service of the platform and just want your website to run, it just works. Like, I deployed it to Azure, everything was fine, it worked great. I mean, I obviously had to, you know, push the data out to SQL Azure database, you know, do some stuff for debug versus release and connection strings and little things like that. But that was stuff I'd have to do anyway for hosting somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So I did all that and it just worked. The sticking points became Live ID, but that's a whole thing that's I can get into, but not really interesting for people who don't work here because they, you know, if you don't work at Microsoft, you'll never run into this problem. So
then don't worry.
Don't worry about that one. But the other trick was then just finding these places where I wanted to take advantage of the Azure runtime. And okay. So it started with, I think the first one we used was we started using blob storage to start putting avatar uploads and in the admin when people upload preview images and they're not done by our backend video encoder. They'll go up there to Azure Blob Storage. And so that was the first thing we started using. We run the dev storage simulator for dev, and then in live, it actually goes against real blob storage. So that was the first one. To do that, I actually ended up writing a little kind of... I do this for everything that has it as an external library. I'll write a little thin kind of wrapper layer so that in my unit tests, I can swap it out. So there's a little thin layer that's just the Azure environment that I ask questions to. That's actually what the caching provider depends on, is that kind of little thin wrapping layer to talk to Azure and figure out all that kind of stuff. And so we had that, and then started doing blob storage. Now, and then the caching, I switched to the memcache thing, turned that on, and then we started using that. That talked to the Azure environment for that. Azure Diagnostics is in there running, so I'm collecting perf counters, event logs, all that kind of stuff. We got a wicked cool console that shows us all the perf counters and awesome graphs and cool little Silverlight app and stuff, so we can monitor the site and see how it goes.
Perfect.
Which was awesome because we handed it out to you guys on the content team to wail on it for a while, and I don't think any of you managed to get it to go above 3% CPU usage.
No.
And this is on a medium machine, and we've done stress tests on it too, and it can hold its own. It's pretty awesome.
Good, man. That's to me the number one thing.
Yep.
All the UI stuff, you know,
exactly.
Great. But...
And the great thing is, and the other advantage we have, and I mentioned this about the caching, is it's 2-3 minutes to turn it up from 1 to whatever number we want, or back down. We keep it at 2 at the baseline, so because for reliability reasons, because we have to do like an OS upgrade, we don't want the set to go down. But if you have 2, they'll upgrade 1, then upgrade the other. So we've got 2 for each. They're the medium-sized roll, which is just a dual proc with like 4 or 8 gigs of RAM, I can't remember. But that's it, and it can, you know, it runs the site screaming at like 1% CPU usage if there are a lot of people hitting it. We'll see how high we can get it. Duncan pegged it at 80 and it started to slow down. It never crashed though.
Okay.
That was actually the best part, is that it got real slow, but it never went down.
Sure.
And so we'll from my gut feel tells me that we should scale pretty linearly. Like we should just, you know, if one node can handle 100, then 2 nodes can handle 200, and 3 nodes can handle 300. Like there's not a lot of dependence on the nodes, and as long as the load balancer in Azure is doing its business, which it does a great job of,
yeah,
we should be good. And
well,
so,
I mean, in some sense, that's sort of the promise of Azure. I mean, it's elastic scale. I mean, Duncan is sort of the grand poopah who goes to the website and adjusts configurations. He's also a hell of a developer, writes a lot of code.
Exactly.
So we're just playing with you, Duncan. So let's say we get pounded, say it's PDC, PDC 10. And we have a lot of great content on Channel 9 to support it. We could imagine that, well, we're going to have more traffic. So therefore, you have to go to a website, open it up, and say, I need 5 more nodes. Save. Boom.
Yep.
Now we're running on 5 more nodes.
Exactly.
Or 20 more nodes,
yep.
Or 30 more nodes. So that's a nice model, and you should be able to take advantage of that. So when I change the number of nodes that Channel 9 is running on, so Duncan goes in and makes a change, says we're on 5, now we're going to go to 10. These are just made-up numbers.
Yeah.
What does your code do? Does your code have to do anything?
The only piece of code that even remotely cares about that is the if he changes the number of memcache nodes as well,
okay.
Which he might not need to. I have that little bit of code that will listen and
perfect.
Adapt. But other than that, everything works the same. Because when a new node spins up, it's the same as if I'm deploying for the first time. I've just sent Azure a package, essentially, like, whenever you need to make a new node, here's everything you need.
Mm-hmm.
And then it spins up the node. I mean, it'll take a little bit of time. The nodes, it doesn't come up instantly because it's got to, you know, initialize, go through all the busy. Like, you know, my code does have startup. But
yeah.
It's not on the load balancer until my node says I'm ready.
Awesome.
And so when my node says it's ready, it's ready.
Perfect.
And And the best part is then when you hit that node for the first time, unlike now, and you ask it for the homepage, it goes, all right, let me check the cache. Well, mm-hmm. it's already all there because the other nodes have been filling it the whole time and keeping it up to date. And so it just serves you the homepage right out of cache.
Perfect.
You're good to go.
So now one of the Niners, I want to get to Niners questions. So one of the Niners asked about how come you, you know, did you use patterns and practices?
I did.
And you did.
I did. There was one library used in patterns and practices. That's the Unity dependency injection container for inversion of control design.
Okay.
I think I got all the acronyms out there.
Yeah.
For those of you who aren't familiar with it, you should search for it on the web because people will explain it better than I do. Okay. But essentially it's this. Every component in the whole system defines its dependencies in its constructor. So, for example, the entry controller. In its constructor, it needs, you know, an I entry service. Or actually, it doesn't need the entry service. It needs, like, an I query factory and, like, you know, a paging settings or something. It needs, you know, certain classes. Inside the class, I just assume I always have these because they're required for me to do my work. In a unit test, when I'm testing the methods of this, I will use fake versions of these classes to simulate the behavior I want. Like, for example, I want to make sure that, like, if the query returns zero results, it does this, or, you know, if this call to a service fails, it does this. I can simulate that with my fakes. In the real site, there's a controller factory, which his job is to, you know, new up instances of controllers. Mm. I override the default one, which uses activator.create instance, and I ask Unity to do it. I say, Unity, I would like an entry controller, please. And it says, okay, and it looks at an entry controller and says, I know how to, you know, how do I make one of those? Well, I need a query factory and then a paging settings. And then it recursively asks itself, okay, how do I make a query factory? At this point, it founds that I have, in a configuration class, said, anytime someone asks for an iQuery factory, I want you to give them a query factory. So this is my concrete implementation and my interface. And then it says, okay, well, how do I make a query factory? And then kind of recurses, basically, so what ends up happening is I want an entry controller. An entry controller depends on this, you know, complex object graph, you know, that may have circles and all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's cycled, one object may get dependent on by three or four, depending on but it's a singleton and all that kind of stuff. And so all I want to do is I want to essentially pick up this object graph and just have it exist. And then just work. And so Unity's job for me anyway is to build this object graph for me based on simple type mappings I've described. So entity controller depends on an iQuery factory. At runtime and release, I get this concrete class. But entity controller doesn't know about that or doesn't care. All it says is, look, I need something that will respond to the messages I want to send to a query factory. Somebody else figure that out. And so none of the components go looking for their dependencies. All the dependencies are given to them. So all that's centralized here. And that's what Unity offers me. There are other open source ones out there that you can use. Structure Map, Castle, all those work. Ninject is another one. All those work on that same idea and have different varying feature sets or whatever. I use Unity because it's, you know, it's from us and it's easy and I like it.
Cool.
Oxite used it, and that's where I first kind of cut my teeth on using it with MVC. And so that's the patterns of practice library that I use.
Cool. And Exoteric asks about, we should probably actually call up the site.
Oh, sure.
While I ask this question,
so that
we
switch to the
kill time. I have one question for you while you're doing that.
Sure.
Basically, really, one of the things you were talking about is sort of the usefulness of ratings. And so ratings are going to help the site understand what somebody actually likes. So if they rate something high, you store that information and tie it to the user, and then over a period of time, like Amazon, you're going to say, hey, you might also like this.
Exactly. I mean, that's the idea, is that the rating is...
But it requires people to rate.
It does. And in the first version that will go out, rating is kind of selfish for us. It lets you see the content that's going on. But no one's going to... I mean, I say, you know, I've said this to Dan and Doug before, and they agree with me, is that no one's going to rate unless we give them a reason to. And that's what the great thing about something like Netflix and Amazon does is, if you rate, I'll tell you things you might like. And I can, you know, there's plenty of algorithms out there. Duncan's actually mentioned a couple of great books and sources for that on the in the thread. And that's kind of that's the place I want to take it. Is that
fair enough? The only thing I would argue, and I've argued with Dan about this. I guess I argue with Dan probably too much.
Everybody's argues with Dan.
But in some sense, by giving people the ability to declare their interest, so Exoteric is a great example, right? It's clear that he's really, really interested in functional programming, monads, Eric Meyer, Brian Beckman, Gilad Braca, and programming languages in general. So if there was some way for him to say, I'm really interested only in the programming languages content and some of the deeper dives and whatever. That said, I certainly agree with Dan and Duncan and everybody else in that we should be able to detect outside of ratings that Exoteric is watching a lot of these videos, and so that the next time he comes to the site, we make it obvious to him, like Amazon does to me. When I go to Amazon after being away for 6 months, it says, oh, by the way, we think you're going to like this because the last time you were here, you bought this.
Right.
I never rate anything on Amazon.
Yep.
So I understand.
Yeah, and I think that there's definitely levels where we start to layer on top of that. Mm-hmm. And you can start to kind of, the great part about a detection system like that is that it can grow.
Yeah.
You can start with ratings, and then you can start to throw in, all right, well, let's keep track of videos you watch.
Mm-hmm.
And let's keep, you know, and then the next layer could be, let's keep track of a percentage of video, you know, the percentage of the video you actually watch. Like we can start to kind of, we can grow and teach the system more and more, make it smarter and smarter and smarter. Once we have kind of like that V1 engine out there, I think is interesting. And that's something that appeals to me. Because if we put out V1 of the dumb engine that's just using ratings in a kind of very simplistic tag matching way,
mm-hmm.
and it's right 80% of the time,
mm-hmm.
maybe we don't need to spend the time building an even smarter one when we can go build another feature that's compelling.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything that I can break into small pieces and
mm-hmm.
I can deliver, here's the first piece, and let's see how much of the need that covers. And if it doesn't cover enough, we'll build piece two. But every piece is independently prioritized, and we can try to kind of deliver features faster because nothing is this hulking behemoth
mm-hmm.
that you know, we have to spend a ton of time in getting the first version of. I mean, the site came together in less than a year. I mean, I wasn't really seriously coding on it until, like, September, October.
Right on.
And I didn't have any help until, like, November.
That's
PDC.
True.
And I was even distracted. And, you know, I've been distracted by PDC and, you know, all that kind of same stuff. But, like,
yeah.
We got Karen Joff in December, and now you're getting a site in August. And that's,
mm-hmm.
or, I guess, preview in late July.
Yeah, because we are actually doing this on Monday, as we said we would.
Yep.
So let's go to the thread.
All right.
And let's see what people are asking here.
So, some of these Duncan answered, like, is Ajax officially dead?
Duncan.
Yes. Some of them are, like, one-word answers, and so we
yeah.
can just answer.
So let's go to some of the more architecture ones. So go to the
right.
Bottom, I asked people to be a little bit more. Let's see, what did Sven have anything interesting?
No,
he's upset. I mean, he's not going down, and that's fair, man. But
yeah.
on the other hand, okay. So
smartphones and mobile. I answered this a little bit. It's
okay.
Something that we are interested in, and I'd like to. I load the site on my iPad
mm-hmm.
and make sure it's okay. I really like to know your experience with the Spark View engine. This is Z Owens.
Mm-hmm.
I'm currently using it, finding myself writing a tool to upgrade the code base to .NET 4, so that I can use .NET 4. I'd like to hear the pain points and good points of Spark and C9. So one of the great points I like about Spark, and I can actually pull up this code because I have it, is that I actually use the Spark precompiler.
This was going to be at an interesting angle. But
yes.
Okay.
So I use the Spark precompiler to precompile all the views. So for those who don't know how Spark works under the hood, Spark is a very simple translation engine that generates a CS file and then compiles it to make a class. And so if anyone's doing Spark, I would argue that's the most important thing to remember, is that Spark is making a CS file and then compiling it. And so they have an installer you can use
mm-hmm.
that lets you use this batching stuff. And so you use a system.configuration.install. Was that control plus or shift plus? What's the...
I really don't know. I use Mark Rusinovich's...
Oh, there we go. Control mouse wheel works.
All right.
So you make this precompiler installer that it depends on these batches, and you just tell it, like, I'd like to batch these controllers, and you can, you know, optionally tell it about some other things that you need to include.
Okay.
And then what this will do is I run this as a build step in release mode, where I'll actually build a DLL that pre-compiles all of those CS files. So at runtime, I'm not doing any compilation, I'm just preloading them. It's a similar concept to the ASP.NET precompiler that's already out there for web forms. But I use this to speed things up, and it's really handy. But one of the pain points is that the way it determines what assemblies are available for the compiler is kind of funky, and so you've got to do some dirty tricks. But yeah, so I use that, and then I grab that assembly. So when I deploy it to Azure, the site spins up faster, and when you don't pay that, Spark will cache it the first time, but this way you don't pay any price the first time either.
Cool.
And so deployment in and making that, it's probably better cloud cover stuff, but making deployment something that's much faster and easier and automatic. Like, I deploy to the site from Visual Studio.
Awesome.
Like, I right-click and say publish, and then push it up to Azure right from there.
Wow.
And that's been, every time we have to, like, do something else to the package, where, like, I've got to include this file, or I want to make sure I do this encryption or whatever, I figure out how to do it and build it into the build so that deployment is so much easier than it is now.
Perfect. Absolutely.
Talked a little bit about Azure and the caching mechanism. We went over that. To a special implementation for video encoding running on Azure. It doesn't run on Azure. We'd like it to, but it doesn't.
It's totally possible.
It could. Totally possible. When switching to Azure and related technologies, what were the two top humps to get your brain wrapped around? This is a good one. For Azure, the most important thing to remember is when your package goes out there, you're essentially spinning up on a new machine. It's almost kind of like you're not really writing an installer, but you're a guest on this machine, and your machines don't stick around, and they don't stay. And so you've got these kind of like little startup bits that you'll do, and that the biggest, toughest things to wrap your head around are storage and just thinking in a scalable way. And like, for example, we want to have everybody cache our CSS and JavaScript files for a really, really long time. So the first time you come to the site, you'll get all that stuff. But as you move around, you're not getting those combined files over and over again. Mm-hmm. But when we push a new version, we don't want to mess you up. And so we put a little cache, what we call the cache buster, a little token in the URL that when we deploy again, will change, and thus all your cache will be invalid. You know, you won't have the new file, and you'll just use the new file. So that way, when we push a new version, you get all the new files right away, and you don't have to worry about this kind of, I've got old CSS or old JavaScript. I have to make sure that when I generate that, it's the same no matter how many nodes there are, and that later when a new node comes online, it generates the same number as all the other ones that are previous. And so there's little things like that where you just got to kind of don't think about one machine, two machines, three machines. Imagine you have N. You have more. You always have more than one, because you should always have two nodes at least. And the more you can kind of embrace the stateless nature of HTTP and the idea that every request comes to you all on its own, mm-hmm. and you should treat it all on its own and respond to it as if it's its own thing, and everything's in a, every request is its own thing, and you don't know sessions, all that kind of stuff. The more you can code like that, the better you'll be, because you're scalable. Because if you treat every request as an atomic unit that comes in, the load balancer sends it to one machine, that machine processes it and sends a request, and then it's done. The only thing that's in durable storage is actual stuff that, you know, should be saved, the actual state that's shared across the whole site, then you're a lot more scalable. You're not functional, because you have side effects because you're storing a database forever, but you have that kind of flavor, that idea of this package can go to any one of my nodes, they will process it faithfully, and then send that person on their way. And when the next request comes in, it can go to a different node, and mm-hmm. that person will process it faithfully, and then it'll go away. And that's the way you got to think. And just always kind of think, always having running those what ifs in your head, like, well, what if there are 10 nodes, or what if the second request goes to a different place, and all that kind of stuff, and figuring out what if this, what if that. And the designs that emerge from that end up being fast and good in other ways. It's kind of it's a nice side effect.
Perfect. All right, let's go down to another one.
So Forum Software is quoting. Oh, this is the quotes stuff that Webber was asking about. Mm-hmm. Where like in the so in the current site, there's that in reply to, which was kind of complicated and interesting. Definitely pushes the envelope. But we've switched to, you know, standard forum style quoting, and that is what it is. Mm-hmm. I think that's
it's back to the future.
It's a simpler, more scalable system that has less dependence on the database. And yes, if you post something that's messed up and has typos and someone quotes you and you go back and edit your original post, they don't get updated. Sorry.
Well, then again,
you can ask them nicely to change it. You can ask us if it's something that, like, you know, needs to come out. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we're not fixing your typos, but if, you know, you put some information in it that, you know, needs to get removed, we'll find it and remove it.
Yeah,
all
just
kind of
send
stuff.
Us an email.
Like, you know, that kind of stuff. Yep. But that is an interesting idea, but I think that it's more of a, it's like I was saying, one of those, the simple solution gets you so far that, and to get that last little bit is so much work and headache and maintenance and extra stuff that the couple times it will be useful are small enough that there are other things that are higher priority. If I had infinite time, maybe, but.
Well, you know, it's kind of silly to embed a post inside of a post. I mean, the benefit is, like you said, you get two requests instead of one, which is, you know, let's be honest, that's not good.
And I think a lot of it was also to help you give context. So the forums are also flat now, for those who didn't see that. The forums don't have a hierarchy. It's not like a tree view we're showing to you flat, like mm-hmm. before currently. It's just a flat list. And I think one of the reasons we did it this way was we want to try to give you a lot of context for when you're reading a post, like, you know, who is this talking about, what's this in reply to, or things like that. But I think that I can give you that context in another way by making the site really freaking fast. If there's so little, if the cost of jumping back three pages and then jumping ahead two, and like the browsing time for that is fast, then you're not paying that much of a price. Like, it's okay that I've removed some context because you can reacquire it so quickly by just flipping through it. It's like, if you have a physical book, it's easy to keep your finger in two or three pages and flip back and forth. But, you know, if it takes you 20 seconds to change a page, then you want to make sure you have all that context right there because, you know, changing is so expensive. So if I can get the site fast, then we don't need as much of this.
Come on, this is quoting. I mean, let's move on to a different question.
Exactly. Anonymous commenting, I can't see a captcha on that screenshot. Spam. Duncan actually brought this up, and we're investigating captchas now. They're
good.
There for release.
Good.
Report specific replies in the forum thread as spam as well as the threads themselves. That's actually all plugged into the back end, and we're hooking up the UI today. Liking the return of quotes, me too. We'll have the ability to have an email me link on the Niners profile. I don't know off the top of my head. My guess would be if we do notifications, email notifications, which Duncan really, really, really wants to do, and I really, really want to do, that could be something we could figure out. It's not included which users have started the thread and the last poster, which of those is which. We may not be doing that anymore, where we highlight the person who started the post. Well, we do in comments, but I don't think we do in the forums. When the preview comes out, get in there and take a look at the UI. And once you can use it, maybe you can get a little more.
Interesting that many of these questions are not architecture questions or anything related to that, but that's okay. Keep on going.
Yeah.
Somebody must ask some.
Will search work? Search actually. We'll keep using Bing for our search, which is actually pretty cool. The language stuff I actually mentioned. I replied to this under the thread.
Yes, that's a good one actually. What's the story there?
So the. What I want to find, we're, you know, language. There's a language field in entries now.
Great.
And the thing I want to find out for people is when are they hitting that? Where are these non-English videos? Or, you know, if you don't want to see English videos, you want to see, you know, Spanish mm-hmm. videos. Where are the places in the site,
recent,
specifically on Rev9, where it pops up?
Recent media. So if you go to browse,
right? Yes. So
and hit recent.
Our stats show that that's a pretty... That page isn't visited very much.
But
it's
a
very small section of the site. Now, there are places, I think, where it's more in your face. And I think related to the number one. when you go to some video about like, you know, one of the office casual ones talks about PowerPoint, and the top three, you know, the three related videos are all like, you know, this series from a, you know, developer in China who's, you know, doing PowerPoint training content or PowerPoint development content for China. And it, like that kind of seeping in there, I can see that. And that's definitely something that I can think of a pretty easy fix. I can have related just be English plus the current video's language or something like that.
But just to say, the recent is essentially, you're right that it's not perhaps super visited in the current UI, but in the new UI, when you click on the browse button, you see recent first. That's how it's. So if you have 15 videos that a Mexican developer evangelist has made in Spanish, and he just posts them, and you go to browse on the new site, and the first thing you're going to see are 15 videos in Spanish.
Yep.
And to me, we should do something to prevent that.
Yep.
Just see English.
Yep. And it's there's a current 9 lets you set a language on your user profile, and I bring that field forward.
So there's a solution.
It's there. I want to take a look at it because I want to take a look at it. We'll see how it goes. Like the more I encumber queries, the trickier it becomes, and I've got to make sure I inject it all in the right places and stuff. And a lot of these services and queries don't know who you are.
Sure.
Like they don't know your they don't take the current user. Some of them do because they're like security based.
Sure.
But very few of them actually do that. And so there's lots of little plumbing of places where there are parts of the code that don't need to know about that now need to start knowing. And
yeah,
I a couple designs.
Fair
are
enough, man.
Let's
fair
see
enough.
How it goes.
All right, let's.
We agree that it's an issue. Something about llamas.
Yeah, we got to move on.
Web trends. We'll move through this.
That's beer is back. Right on, beer. I can't believe you just can't give this up. But keep on going.
Red on comments. Something we could do. How often can we see sub revisions? The code is so much easier to edit now. Part of that because of the things I was talking about earlier, where it's a lot easier to know what the site's doing, and so it's easier to change it. The site is also a surprisingly small amount of code. I did a line of code check, and it's like it's under 10,000. It's a very, very small site.
Cool.
More stuff. This is some stuff about like suggestions and tags and that kind of stuff, and we've hit on that. Hilarious llama pictures. This is fun.
So Exoteric asked some interesting things there.
Yes. So seen but not rated videos, and so you can remind them to do that. That's interesting. It's something as we start to kind of get a sense of what the rating feature is and how it gets used and start to kind of build ideas on top of that. I will say that all the features that I talk about, that's something we want to do. All of them get to, you know, go into the cage match that is the priority setting process and have to fight all the other features for our time. And so, there's some things we're doing obviously that, you know, have other business impacts that, you know, align around events or whatever that may knock some of this stuff out, but putting these things in will be so much easier than it was before. So hopefully that will help us get more in. But some of these more revisions on ratings and getting people more ways to see their content, I think is also interesting. Me asking for other stuff. What specific? This question made me laugh because I didn't know how to answer it. What specific changes have been made to allow for an increase in requests throughput while decreasing latency from both a software and hardware perspective? A lot of that is having the caching be more aggressive. The hardware perspective change is that I guess we're in Azure. You'll get a bit more of a software latency from the DNS resolution. But
well, the only thing I would say there is remember that you're running through David Cutler's hypervisor implementation.
That's true.
So Dave Cutler works for Azure. Everybody knows that. And he's done an unbelievable job on the operating system we call Windows Azure.
Yep.
So rock and roll.
Yeah. A lot of the ways I've increased requests and throughput is ruthlessly stripping the IIS pipeline of everything that isn't doing exactly what I want it to do. I'm not joking. it's IIS comes with a lot of great built-in modules, and that's nice, but I don't need them. Mm-hmm. And so I kick them out. And I've got a little lightweight way to run modules such that I can kind of... This is a hard subject to get into. Okay, so the IIS pipeline is basically when IIS request comes in, there's a series of events that will fire, and you can find a list of them. There's about 23. There's one in the middle that's like the actual handler that actually takes your request and is responsible for returning your result. All the modules do, so like static filtering, authentication, all that is there just these objects that you register with IIS. They're singletons that live in your process that respond to one of those events and then do stuff. And each one of those events, you get like the full context of the request, and you can touch things like, you know. And so the second, you know, the begin request is the first. The second one is authentication, and that's the event where you authenticate the user. And so forms auth runs there, you know, Windows auth, impersonation, all that stuff all runs at that level.
Okay.
I've removed all of them, and so they don't run because I run mine, and my auth is actually my own controller, which will check your live ID, check username, and password. But it's a much smaller code because we have very specific auth requirements, and so I got rid of all those. And then, you know, authentication, like role checking, we don't use role checking, so I got rid of it. You know, profile and personalization, like the role providers from ASP.NET, I don't use them, so I got rid of them. And so I cleared out as much of the pipeline as I could to kind of make it so that all the code that's running is running with purpose, and that purpose is known to me and understood.
Awesome.
And a lot of, I would recommend to every ASP.NET developer out there who, you know, really needs to spend a lot of time getting to know ASP.NET to really understand IIS7 and that pipeline and what's going to happen in a request. To figure and like, you know, go and get the reference source. Like, we put it up on the web for a reason, go get it. Mm-hmm. And that, and read it and understand what ASP.NET's doing. Like, it's not, it's complicated, and you'll spend, you know, it'll take you months and, you know, it took me years to really get a good grasp of what it's doing. But the rewards are huge. You'll be able to build a site that's much faster. When things go wrong, you'll understand why, because the pipeline is very simple in its design. And once you get it in your head and you internalize it, you can do a lot of interesting things. And like all my HTTP modules actually aren't singletons. I create them using my Unity dependency injection container, and so I can write these little lightweight modules that can depend on everything else in the stack, and everything just, it kind of flows and works with the whole rest of the site. And I don't have, my web config is much simpler because it's all just done right there in process, very lightweight, and everything kind of happens at the right time. It does it, and that kind of just attention to those little details, I think, is the big thing that I can do to help improve throughput, and just getting the, also relentlessly running profiling tools against it. There's an nhprof that's a Hibernate profiler, which will, you just hook it up and it'll tell you like all the SQL requests that are coming out, give you warnings and errors when you're making mistakes and that kind of stuff. And I've been running that against the site, probably not as much as I need to. That's actually one of the reasons, things I'm most interested in, mm-hmm. when the beta gets out there or the preview or whatever, is how fast is it with me having done some perf tuning, but having a long list in my head of so many more things I can do. And there are a lot more things we can do to get it even faster, mm-hmm. but it really makes me feel good and proud that mm-hmm. it's as fast as it is before I've done that. I feel like I've got a lot of room to mm-hmm. keep getting it faster, but that I'm starting from a good place.
Excellent.
Like, that's, when I click around the site, it's quick.
It is. I have noticed. Very nice.
And that's the ultimate goal, because if I can, when the site's fast, you can click around, you can explore, you don't feel this penalty of, I can't leave this thread, or, you know, I need to make sure I've got everything here because, you know, clicking next page is going to take me 20 seconds. But if you're like, you know, less than one, things get a lot better. And so so getting it fast and keeping it fast is always in my head.
Perfect. So on that note, it looks like we've reached the end of the thread. There's no more questions, I assume.
Yeah, that's everything. Holiday themes. Yes, we'll probably
holiday themes. Yeah, very important. And that's actually implemented as a monad. It's a holiday theme monad,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Hey, this is great.
For V6, I'm going to rewrite the whole thing in F#.
You should.
I should.
Or Scala.
Or Scala, yeah.
Why not?
In all seriousness, though, I'm getting an Iron Ruby, and I've been wondering about what I can do to bring some dynamic. And that's one of the reasons I wanted .NET 4, is I really want to get dynamic into my view pages.
Cool.
And be able just to kind of, like, assemble all the data it needs and pass it down. Maybe if you ever come back, I can show you all.
No, I'll definitely come back.
All the parts of the code that are ugly and that I hate.
Hey, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, you're using a statically typed imperative programming language called C#.
Yep.
And you have to do what you have to do.
Yep.
Because there certainly is a benefit to declarative functional kind of things, right? So, yes, you could use F#. Great language. But so is Ruby. So
yep.
is Python.
Yep.
So is Scala.
Yep.
So I look forward to the day when Channel 9, when you're starting to do some crazy stuff back there, which you've already done. It's clear you've done excellent work, Sampi. I think this architecture will scale. And time will tell.
Yep.
Whether or not Niners will be nice. So, you know, I hope that you know. Fortunately, not all Niners are harsh, but you know, developers can be mean, man.
Yep. Yep.
I'll
be happy to throw down and get into the code.
But this is great. Yeah. Finally, let's take just a quick look at what you've done here in terms of the technologies adopted.
Yep.
So, .NET 3.5 SP1, MVC 2.0, Unity, and Hibernate, Fluent and Hibernate, Memcached. NEM managed Memcached driver, Azure Fabric Storage Diagnostics, SQL Azure, XUnit. You've done a lot of unit testing, by the way.
I think we've got
1,600,
1,300? I think. Let me pull up the number. Oh, it wants to build. Why do you want to build? I've got 869. I think we trimmed some. Haha. Yeah, we're at 1,200 right now.
Perfect.
I love when I get to delete tests, because that means I got to delete code, which makes me happy.
Good. Live ID, which we briefly touched on. Spark Fusion Engine, which you mentioned. AskMet for
the spam filtering.
Which I'm really worried about spam and anonymous comments, by the way, but this video isn't about my concerns. Anti-XSS was always great,
yep.
just cross-site scripting stuff.
Yep.
TinyMCE.
That's our editor. It's the same one that Nine uses, but RedNine uses it as well.
Perfect. jQuery, which is an excellent JavaScript library.
Yep.
And of course, Silverlight,
yep.
which is our player and various other things.
Exactly.
Various other things, meaning some of the UI on the player, I assume.
Yeah. That whole thing is
A Silverlight
yep.
object.
And we fixed the issue where if you clip the video too fast, you get the download.
Excellent, man.
So.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Hey, always great to talk to you, Sampi. Fantastic work.
Mm-hmm.
And when people are watching this, they're probably watching it on the new Rev 9 preview.
No,
but
that,
we'll see if
yeah.
that's if that happens.
I'll get Duncan to run a sync so we make sure it's on there.
Rock and roll, man.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks.